Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Are we fed up enough by now with Republicans to get ourselves to the polls in sufficient numbers to assure that they do not retake control and resume the agenda of the previous administration, which included tax cuts for the rich, gutting of labor protections, erasing separation of church and state, legalizing racial and sexual discrimination, privatizing public institutions, and of course, gutting environmental protections? Well, even if we are motivated, it might not matter as much as we have reason to expect, not if the state-by-state assault on voting rights is allowed to proceed in the absence of a comprehensive federal voting rights law, such has been proposed. But to get that passed, we need to eliminate the Senate filibuster, and in order to do that, we need every Democrat in the Senate to agree, and that includes two of the most disagreeable Democrats, West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, and that seems unlikely at the moment. But voting rights are not the Republicans' only strategy for retaking control. States will begin the process of redistricting soon, a feat that follows the census every 10 years, and this is their opportunity to further gerrymander the state districts to their advantage. That's a cumbersome process that's not well understood by most folks, and really, why should we have to understand it? It should be done by professionals based on data and basic democratic rules, right? But it isn't, and it hasn't been. Yes, both Democrats and Republicans are guilty of gerrymandering in the past, but the new federal voting rights legislation, proposed by Democrats and opposed by Republicans, would put an end to gerrymandering altogether. This past week, the Ohio Environmental Council held an online seminar on Ohio's redistricting process with some very expert and thorough explanations and opportunities to get involved. So this week, I want to present part of that seminar to you in hopes of both explaining it in a way that anyone can understand and also to emphasize its critical importance.
Thanks, Chris. As Chris said, my name is Justin Kwasa. I'm the Voting Rights Program Director at League of Conservation Voters Education Fund, and really excited to be with you. I'm coming to you from Washington, D.C., but even though I'm not from Ohio, I did try to wear my best Buckeye red. I know it's not the exact colors, but, you know, I'm trying. Just work with me, please. Really excited to have this conversation just because, obviously, redistricting is something that's huge across the country, and it's really going to politics in our country, both on the local, state, and federal level for the next 10 years. So really excited to be a part of this conversation. And want to start off with a question I usually get being a representative from the League of Conservation Voters, which is, why are we interested in redistricting? Why is an environmental group interested in doing any of this work when, you know, we should be focused on the environment? And what we like to say is that a healthy democracy is directly connected to a healthy environment. While democracy doesn't have direct environmental connections, when we look at democracy and where it fails people, the environment has some of the best stories that make that connection. We know that everybody wants healthy land. We know that everybody wants clean air and clean water. Yet we live in a system where that doesn't always happen because people can buy their way or influence their ways in certain ways in order to make sure that doesn't happen. And so what we need to do as an environmental organizations is really start playing chess and use all the tools in our toolkit in order to make sure that we can create a system that creates the most healthy environment and the most protected environment that we can. And that's why we care about democracy. That's why we care about voting. And that's why we especially care about redistricting, which has a huge effect on the game of politics that is played that ultimately leads to positive and good environmental policy. So in addition to everything that I said, you know, we also really care about redistricting because the communities that are most susceptible to environmental injustice are also the ones that we know are most likely to be discriminated at the polling places and will be drawn out of districts and drawn out of representation during this redistricting process. So we need to make those connections and make sure that these communities are represented in our local, state, and national seats of power. And we're gonna go into this a little bit later, but there are any number of ways that people can draw out or disenfranchise communities based off of how they draw the maps and what specifically people care about drawing the maps in a way where that voice isn't fully represented in our democracy. So that's why an environmental group is here in the democracy space and talking about redistricting, is because we need to make sure we have as equitable of a democracy as possible. Because when we know that happens, we know that people will always vote for proper environmental policy and to protect their environment and their communities. So with that being said, we can't have any conversation about redistricting without first talking about the 2020 census. And the 2020 census, as you know, happened last year. And just a couple of things that we want to know that will actually come that will come back around a little later in the conversation. Number one, we know that throughout the country in the past 10 years, the country is moving away from the East Coast and Midwest, which is unfortunate, and moving to the South and West. And so when you look at the states that gain seats, they're mostly on the West Coast and in the South, like North Carolina, Colorado, Florida, and Texas, which actually got two seats. And then we look at the states that lost a congressional seat, they do fall mostly in the Midwest, including, unfortunately, Ohio. But within those trends, here's what we're seeing. We're seeing that non-white communities are growing at a faster rate than the national average, as well as for white communities. And that's really significant because, as we'll talk about a little bit later, the way maps are drawn, we can either strengthen or take away the voice of those communities and the voice of those communities, depending on how we redraw these maps. And so that's going to be extremely important in order to have the most equitable maps so that we can represent this change in demographics so we can really get the environmental policy that we know that we need for now and also for the future. And then finally, we know right now I'm speaking to you from a C3 standpoint, but it's not C3 it's totally possible from a C3 standpoint to say that redistricting is going to have a significant effect of who controls the House after this midterm election. Right now, as you see at the bottom, is a very narrow separation between Democrats and Republicans. And the way that the maps are drawn in a couple of states can make that difference. Obviously, people going out to vote is the most significant factor of that, but also redistricting plays a significant factor in that as well. So let's talk about the timeline. So one of the things I want to get through to you today, as we go into like what you can do in Ohio, is to say that nationally, there have been a lot of attempts to adjust how the data for redistricting has been collected in order to disenfranchise a lot of communities that we're talking about right now. It all starts way back in March of 2018 when the Trump administration specifically added a citizenship question to the census. And so that was obviously used to scare and to deter a lot of communities, particularly in the Latinx and immigrant communities, from participating in the census. And we know that a census is so important in order to account every single person that lives in the country so that we can respond properly and that we can represent properly all the communities that make up our country. Fortunately, the Supreme Court struck it down, and so that crisis was averted there. So then in January of 2020, census collection began. We started in Alaska. Everything seemed to go great. We were going to have a really great census. And then something happened during the spring that kind of threw everything for a loop. I don't know if you guys remember it, but that happened. So that threw a lot in. Number one, obviously, you know, the door-to-door collection of census data was thrown out of whack. And once again, that mostly affects the Black and brown communities that we talked about earlier that are affected both on the environmental side as well as the democracy side most substantially. And so eventually, you know, the collection deadline was pushed back to August 3rd. And so we were able to, you know, with that additional timeline, try to make up as much as we can and get an accurate count as possible. And so now we're here in 2021, where in April, the Census Bureau released the population count and the quality metrics. That is our first look into what redistricting is going to look like. And that's where we got the numbers that I mentioned earlier about where states, we know which states will, at least on the federal level, will receive more seats or less seats in Congress. So with that being said, I just want to give you a quick idea of like where everybody in the country stands and how redistricting is done in each of the states. So we talked about earlier where, you know, Ohio is in a in a situation where, you know, the legislature is responsible for it with governor approval. And for most of the country, that is how it actually happens. But one of the important things I want folks to know is that there also are additional processes that that states get to their redistricting. I also want to notice, too, that this is for federal redistricting, and there can be a difference between federal redistricting and where how you assign people to Congress, and then how people are assigned in your state legislature as well as in your local thing. So this is only for federal redistricting, and we'll go into the state a little bit later. But the biggest thing I want you to know is that across the country, one of the biggest trends is to have independent commissions that are made up of folks that are not politicians coming together to make maps in order to attempt to be as fair as possible. Obviously, no system is perfect, but the idea that legislatures are able to determine where the lines are doesn't sit right well with a lot of democracy champions. And so just wanted to highlight that a lot of states, as you see, once again, out west, it seems to be most popular, but are trying to go with the trend of going to independent risk commissions rather than have politicians do there. And, you know, these are conversations that are going to be happening for the next 10 years. It's about, you know, who has the right and who should be making these maps. Coming to this summer, now that we have the now that we know kind of, at least on the federal level, how the seats are going to be distributed, right now what's happening across the country is we're advocating for redistricting protections that are located in two pieces of legislation in particular, which is the For the People Act, which is S1, and then also the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which is HR4. And so I want to very quickly kind of go through what's in there in both of those. So number one, for the People Act, which is right now sitting in Congress and waiting for has recently been voted on, but has been filibustered. And so we're waiting on the next action after the filibuster. Ultimately, what the For the People Act is trying to do is try to make every single state, at least for their federal redistricting requirements, be done by independent redistricting committees, as well as put in national guidelines in order to make sure that whatever map comes out of all these states aren't racially discriminatory and don't, lessen the voice of any community. So I know this is a lot right here, but I can also, like, in the chat once we're done, drop a link for the Brennan Center, who has like a full markup and a full annotated version of what the specific redistricting provisions are. But just want to also let you know that in this act that is mostly about voting rights, there is a redistricting portion in there that is really important. And also champions are trying to pass this by August so that these laws can be in place in time for redistricting in all the states across the country. The only other thing I want to do is also really quickly talk about the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which was passed in 2019 in the previous Congress, but once again got dropped off in the Senate. And ultimately what it does is restore Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is very important for voting rights issues. But what happened was actually 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court actually made another decision that affected Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which does jeopardize the fair redistricting process, as this is the main act that people use if maps are not drawn fairly or if maps are discriminatory. This is the main law that they use in order to fight back against it. So right now what's happening across the country is that there are being field hearings taking place in order to figure out how do we adjust this act in order to deal with modern day suppression and not suppression that we saw in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So just also want to know that on the national level in DC, that's really what we're fighting for in order to affect the redistricting process in states like Ohio. So the final thing that I wanted to highlight before I pass it on and we really get Ohio specific is next month in August, we are expecting the redistricting data to be released. This is something that, you know, was expected to be released back in April, but once again, because of COVID, because of all the delays, it has been pushed back until August. And from there, it is a sprint to the finish to go from August all the way till the end of this year because, midterms are coming and we need to make sure that everybody knows what piece of turf they're running for and running on. And so it is going to be it is going to be an intense process. And so really, you know, starting in September, We need you to get to work. And so that's why we're so happy that all of you are here in order to talk about how you can best affect this system. So with that, that's all I have to say. I really appreciate you, Chris, and OEC for inviting me, and really looking forward to the discussion and figuring out how we can draw the best and most equitable maps in Ohio. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Justin. That was a great overview of what's going on at the national level. Yes, that's a good question. Justin, what are quality metrics?
Yeah, absolutely. So that actually didn't have anything to do with the redistricting part. But quality metrics are essentially releasing kind of the full breadth of the metrics that were included, just so that statisticians can look at the metrics and make sure that it is actually statistically representative of the population. So it's just a very transparent measure that the census is doing for the first time this year, allowing statisticians in order to look at the as full of the data as possible, obviously not including personal information, but allowing them to look at the data in order to independently verify that the census is a statistically significant and respectable survey of the American people.
Yeah, I think I was kind of wondering what quality metrics were. I kind of had a guess. I'm glad you explained that and that someone asked that question.
My name's Katie Shanahan. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm the Ohio State Director with All on the Line. We are a grassroots advocacy campaign that's part of a national effort to end gerrymandering and to restore fairness to our redistricting process. And the Ohio redistricting process is a really unique opportunity because it is entirely new. We completely overhauled how we will go through the redistricting process in 2015 and in 2018 when Ohioans overwhelmingly supported two different redistricting reform measures that not only changed who draws our maps, but also how they have to draw our maps. So I'm going to go over how that redistricting process will actually work. But before that, I just want to do a little bit of a level setting conversation to talk about what the last decade has looked like for Ohio living under some of the most gerrymandered districts in the country. The reality is that for the last 10 years, Ohioans have been effectively denied any real form of adequate political representation, both at the congressional level and the state legislature level, because our district lines just do not adequately reflect how we actually vote. Ohio is a purple state. I will die on that hill. We are not a red state. You can see the pie charts here. Across the decade, we split almost 50-50 down the middle, with Republicans just edging out Democrats 55-45, and yet that is not what we see reflected in the seats of the delegation that we send to DC to Congress, or certainly in our state house. So even though across the decade, across the entire lifespan of our current maps, even though Republicans won just 55% of the statewide vote share in congressional races, they walk away with a whopping 75% of our seats. And that is a proportion of seats that has been unchanged for the entire decade. Republicans have gotten 12 of our 16 seats for the last 10 years, even though they have won nowhere near 75% of the vote. You see that same sort of discrepancy in our state legislative races. So again, even though Republicans are just picking up 55% of the vote, they enjoy supermajorities in both chambers in the state house. They occupy about 65% of the seats. And the reason that you have this discrepancy is solely because of our gerrymandered districts, that you have such a difference between how Ohioans are actually voting and who occupies those seats is something that we are trying to fix during this redistricting cycle in 2021. And it's our once in a decade opportunity to do so. But what is it actually meant to live under those districts? It means that we have not been able to make any progress on any number of issues that Ohioans care about or address the needs that our communities have, because our legislators are not actually accountable to us as their voters, because we essentially don't elect them. Our gerrymandered district lines elect them. In 2011, during the redistricting process, certain politicians cheated to gerrymander those lines to manipulate them to favor one political party over the other. And that means, especially in the realm of the climate and the environment, that we are not able to make progress on things that actually reflect how Ohioans feel. So maybe this is wild to hear, but Ohioans overwhelmingly support acting on climate, investing in renewable energy. You would never be able to guess that based on all of the terrible bills that are churned out of the Ohio State House, especially the one that Governor DeWine just signed into law the other day, which would make it even more difficult for localities to install wind farms. This is something that we shouldn't be debating at this point, and we wouldn't be if it weren't for our gerrymandered districts. So when we say that it is all on the line in our fight for fair maps, we literally mean it. We will not be able to make progress on any major issue at the state or federal level if we do not fix our maps. And I could not possibly underscore enough the urgency of now and the importance of this process, particularly in the realm of fighting the harmful impacts of climate change, which we are seeing every single day, and especially among those communities, like Justin was saying, the communities who are bearing the brunt of climate change are the exact same marginalized communities whose voices are diluted by our gerrymandered districts, who are suppressed at the ballot box. That is not a coincidence. So fixing this issue is so, so crucial. Okay, I'm going to start to go over this redistricting process. It is a bit of a doozy. There are two different processes that we use to draw our maps. One is for the state legislative maps. The other is for our congressional maps. And if you have any questions, please feel free to drop them in the chat box. I will try to keep an eye on those as I'm going through these so that folks can get them answered as we're going through. I'm seeing one in the chat box. Don't rural communities also have more representation than urban areas? Eleanor, that's a great question. The answer is effectively yes. Just because of how our districts are drawn, we essentially give an outsized voice to communities that are not actually representative of the entirety of the state. And so because of how we draw our districts, our map drawers were very good at packing Democrats into as few districts as possible, and then maximizing the Republican districts to sort of eat up all of those other areas. And so you're giving a lot more weight to communities in Ohio and opinions in Ohio that are not reflective of the electorate as a whole. So definitely trying to balance the scales there with fair maps. Okay, so when we're talking about the redistricting process, first we have to talk about who actually runs the map drawing process. There are three main entities to keep in mind. Two of them are who actually draws our maps, and then one of them is who actually judges our maps once they're drawn. So the first entity is a new 7-member redistricting commission. This is replacing what used to be called the apportionment board. And the commission is in charge of drawing our state legislative maps. We'll talk about who's on there in just a second. The second entity to keep in mind is our state legislature. The General Assembly is mostly who's in charge of drawing our congressional maps, although the commission does actually play a role. So Ohio is actually a hybrid state. It's not just the legislature who draws our congressional maps. The redistricting commission does also play a part if necessary. The third entity to keep in mind is the Ohio Supreme Court. Our reform measures in 2015 and in 2018 are now a part of the Ohio Constitution, and the constitutional language provides the Supreme Court what's called original jurisdiction, which for all the non-lawyers on the call means that they are the first court who gets to review any potential challenge relevant to the redistricting process. So it doesn't matter if you are challenging the process itself, the maps themselves, if it is a partisan gerrymandering challenge, if it's a racial gerrymandering challenge, if it's any other type of constitutional challenge, you first go to the Ohio Supreme Court. Whether you can go anywhere else, so if you can appeal it to any other court, especially into federal court, is entirely dependent on what type of challenge you are bringing. So I think Justin mentioned that the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion a few years ago that closed the federal courthouse doors to partisan gerrymandering challenges. So if you want to challenge a map that you think favors one political party over the other, you can no longer go into federal court to do that. You have to stay in state court. If, however, you are challenging the map because you think it is racially gerrymandered, so you think that race was a predominant factor in how districts were drawn, or if it is a federal constitutional claim, or if HR1 ever passed, if you wanted to do an HR1 related claim, you could still go into federal court, but you would first have to go to the Ohio Supreme Court. So these are the three main actors to keep in mind. And the reason, especially the first two are important, is that's who all of your advocacy targets are. So during the process itself, those are the people who are going to be nagging to actually host a fair process. Okay, so the first process that occurs is drawing our state legislative district. So this is our Ohio House and Ohio Senate seats. Like I said, there's a new seven-member commission who's in charge of that. The seven members of that commission are the Ohio governor, the secretary of state, and the auditor, and then four legislative nominees, one each from each of the legislative leaders. So the Speaker of the House, Senate President, and then the minority leaders from both caucuses will each nominate one person to serve on those on that commission. We don't know yet who any of those nominees are because Governor DeWine has not yet convened this commission. So I will go on a little tangent here that we are a month and 3 days away from getting our redistricting data, and we still don't know who's drawing our map because Governor DeWine has not yet convened this district. So if you feel like giving him a buzz to tell him to get to work, I wouldn't be mad at that. So in this process, there are three main steps to get our maps. There are two options to get a map that will last the entire decade, 10 years until the next time we do the census in 2030. And there's one option where we get a four-year map. In order to get a 10-year map, there has to be some level of bipartisan support. And then the four-year map is if they can't get bipartisan support, the Republicans can just push through a four-year map. So let's talk about what those steps are. Step number one, by September 1st of 2021, in order to get a 10-year map, the commission has to vote in favor with just a simple majority, so four of those seven members, including at least two Republicans and both of the Democratic members. The reason for this is that of those seven members, five of them are Republicans, only two are Democrats. The Constitution requires at least two members of each party to vote in favor of the map. Since there's only two Dems, it means you have to get both of them to vote in favor of the map for it to last for the entire 10 years. There are also requirements at every step of the process to host a certain number of public hearings after maps have been publicly proposed, but before they get voted on. And I'll talk about that a little more on the next slide. But again, they've got to get bipartisan support. If they can get both of the Democrats and at least two Republicans to vote in favor of the state legislative maps by September 1st, then we're good to go. We have a 10-year map. If they can't do that, so maybe they can't get that bipartisan agreement, maybe they can't get the deal done in time, we go to step two, and there's a one-time two-week extension until September 15th to try again to get a 10-year bipartisan map. Again, they've got to get both Democrats, at least two Republicans to sign on. They've got to host another hearing. If they can do all that by September 15th, then we're done in step two and we've got a 10-year map. If they cannot get that bipartisan agreement, maybe they can only get one of the Democrats to vote for it. Maybe they can't get either of the Democrats to vote for it. The Republicans, because they have five of the seven members, they obviously have more than a majority of the members. In step three, they can push forward a map still with just a simple majority of the commission members, but that map will only be in place for 4 years. Now, maybe you're thinking to yourself, well, why wouldn't they just zoom through to step three and just do a four-year map? It's a great question. There's nothing stopping them from doing that. There's a couple of reasons why they might not want to do that. The first of which is that the governor, the auditor, and the secretary of state are all up for re-election next year in 2022. And so if they move forward and pass a four-year map, by the time they have to come back to draw the map that would last the remaining 6 years of the decade, the governor, auditor, and secretary of state might be different people and they might belong to different parties. And so if the Democrats pick up two of those three seats, they then would have four of the seven commission member seats, and they then would control this process. So one piece of it is a balance of power issue. So you might have a different party who's in charge of this commission in year five for the redraw. The other piece of it is public pressure and accountability. Republicans and Democrats came out in 2015 and said, yes, we agree with Ohio voters. We want a fair process. We want bipartisan consensus for 10-year maps. And now it's our turn to actually hold them accountable to make sure that they do that. But still, they're able to pass a four-year map. If they do, we just go to step 3A, which is on the bottom right side of this panel, which just says that in year five, they come back together. They go through the whole process all over again, no matter where they land. So no matter if they get bipartisan support or not, that map is then in place for the remainder of the decade. So that's the state legislative process. It's the easier of the two processes. So I hope that wasn't too bad. I'm going to click us ahead then to talk about the new criteria that the state legislative maps have to meet. So in 2011, we had almost no criteria for what the maps had to look like, which is part of the reason why our maps are so gerrymandered. There was almost no guardrails keeping those lines intact and making sure that they were actually fair. So these are all, most of these are brand new rules that are a direct result of the 2015 reform measure. They are all now part of the Ohio Constitution. So every new state legislative map has to meet these criteria, no matter if it's a 10-year or a four-year map. They've all got to meet these rules. The first rule is a fairly traditional redistricting rule. One is that the district lines, the boundaries have to be contiguous. That just means that there's one non-interrupted, non-intersecting line that makes up the border of the district. So what you don't want to have is a little piece of the district over here, and then a totally separate island of the district over here. You want it to all be one area. The other is that the districts have to be compact. This usually isn't a problem for state legislative districts because the population size is pretty small. The other thing with compactness is that it's sort of a double-edged sword, because compactness is also sometimes used as an excuse to pack voters of color together in districts. So just have to be wary of that. But the idea here is that you want to centralize where those districts are so that they are centralized around communities of interest and not sprawling to different parts of the state. The second criterion is that district boundaries should be used or should be created using existing county, city, and township boundaries. The idea here is that we want to try to keep communities together as much as possible. And where we can, we want to be using community boundaries that already exist to guide how we draw districts. In a similar vein, where possible, house districts should not split counties more than one time. The idea here is that we're trying to keep counties together, communities together as much as possible. If you look at our current district maps, they are very masterful at cracking apart communities, which is completely unnecessary for a state like Ohio, because we are a state that is full of small and medium-sized counties, cities, townships that deserve to be included in their entirety within districts. So these are what these criteria, that's the idea that these criteria are trying to get at, is making sure that we're protecting communities against being cracked apart. The next criterion is about how big the districts are. And this goes to the heart of the constitutional promise of one person, one vote. The only way that we can ensure that people are proportionally represented is by drawing districts that are almost equally populated. And so this criterion just says that you can't have districts that vary more than 5% from either the biggest or the smallest district size. The next two criteria are my absolute favorite criteria. The first is that no district map should favor or disfavor one party over the other. That just means you cannot partisan gerrymander our state legislative maps. What does it mean to disfavor a political party? This is where the next criterion comes in. It's not just that there is a blanket ban on partisan gerrymandering. We go one step further, and this next criterion is actually unique to Ohio. We are the only state in the country that has this criterion. We require our future maps to have what's called representational fairness. And to explain this, I'm actually going to go back a couple of slides to these pie charts. So if you're looking over on the right-hand side, you see there's a huge difference between how we vote as Ohioans and who actually occupies the seats. And sorry, the idea of representational fairness is that if you are only winning 55% of the votes, you should also only be occupying about 55% of the seats. Similarly for the Democrats, if you're winning 45% of the votes, you should be occupying about 45% of the seats. If we had district maps that were actually representationally fair, you would not see such a discrepancy between how we vote and who actually wins those elections. And so this criterion is incredibly important to ensuring that our maps are actually representative of how we vote in Ohio. The final criterion is a traditional one in Ohio. It's just how we draw our districts. Every single Senate district in Ohio is just three connected House seats all nested together. So you just take three bordering House seats, draw one big line around them, and that's your Senate seat, which is why there's 33 Senate seats and 99 House seats. Let's see here. Where do independent voters figure into the criteria? Good question, Eleanor. The criteria actually require only looking at sort of like the two major parties who are represented. So you're looking at electoral data from the past decade to judge how Ohioans have voted for statewide, state, and federal elections. And you're looking at general election results. The way that the Constitution is written is that you're looking at how the two major parties are represented. So unfortunately, there's not an explicit measurement for how independent voters factor into this. There's not a huge percentage of Ohio voters who are actually independent. Still though, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be factored into how the districts are drawn, but the Constitution does not explicitly name them in terms of how we decide what the seat share should look like. Okay, so this is the state legislative process. I'm gonna scoot us ahead in the interest of time to our congressional process. This is the more complicated of the two processes, so bear with me, but we'll get through it. You'll see a lot of similarities in this process to the state legislative one. There are bipartisan requirements for any 10-year map. You have to have both Republican and Democrat support for any 10-year map, just like you do with the state legislative process. There are also requirements for public hearings that have to happen after maps have been publicized, but before they get voted on. And you'll see a similar setup where there are multiple opportunities to get a bipartisan 10-year map and one final option to do a four-year partisan map. There is one major difference in this congressional process, which I'll talk about in step four, that makes it a little bit of a different strategy than the state legislative process. But let's dig in. And like I said a couple slides ago, the legislature is who's mostly in charge here, but still in step two, you'll see the Redistricting Commission also plays a part. So in step one, by September 30th, so remember the state legislative maps are due either September 1st or September 15th. And then 2 weeks later is the first congressional map due date, which means these two maps will be drawn at the same time. There will be negotiations about both of them happening, even if not out in public, undoubtedly behind closed doors, which we're going to fight against. But those conversations will happen at overlapping intervals. So in step one, in order to get a 10-year congressional map, by September 30th, the legislature has to pass a map with at least 60% support in both chambers, including at least half of the Democratic caucuses. So half of the Senate Dems, half of the House Dems have to support that. If they can get all that done in their two public hearings that are required by September 30th, we're done in step one, we've got a 10-year map. They can't do that, we go to step two. The process then kicks out of the legislature and goes into the Redistricting Commission. So that seven-member commission who just finished drawing our state legislative district comes into play. They then have 1 month until October 31st to get a bipartisan 10-year map. And then their rules apply. So again, they've got to get at least two Republicans, both of the Democrats, to vote in favor of that map. If they can do that after they hold their hearings, then we're good to go. We have a 10-year map. If the commission can't do that, it goes back to the legislature for step three, and the legislature gets one more shot at passing a 10-year map. In order to get a 10-year map in step three, they again have to get at least 60% support from both chambers, but this time they only have to get one third of the Democratic caucuses, which is not a lot of members. There's only eight Democratic senators, for example. So they've only got two or three senators. They've got about 12 or 13 House members who they've got to get to support those maps step three. If they can do that after their public hearings by November 30th, then we're good to go. We have a 10-year map. If they can't do that, we go to step four, and step four is where there's a bit of a big difference. So here is where the four-year map comes in. The legislature can just pass this with a simple legislative majority, which, like I said, the Republicans have, and then some, they've got super majorities in both chambers. That map, if they do pass that with no real Democratic support, would only be in place for 4 years. So maybe, again, you're thinking, well, why won't they just do a four-year map? here's the major kicker. First and foremost, in 4 years, when they come back in year five, there will be new legislators in office, right? The legislative maps have been drawn by that commission. They will hopefully be much more fair. You could potentially have a Democratic majority in the House, not likely in the Senate, just given numbers. You could have it in the House. And so maybe you have different power dynamics, because what we, fingers crossed, will not see is supermajorities for Republicans in either chamber. And so they're going to have to actually work together with Democrats, gasp, to get those maps passed. So you might have different power dynamics in that last step. The other major stick that's hanging over their head to not pass a four-year map is that there are additional stricter rules that apply to the map if it is passed for 4 years in step four, which I'll talk about in a second. But I'll tell you right now, the Republicans are not going to want those extra strict rules on their maps. So they're probably going to try to avoid four-year maps. Step 4A, which is on the bottom right panel here, just explains what happens if they do pass a four-year map. They just come back in year five, just like the state ledge process. They go through the whole thing again. If it doesn't matter where they stop in the process in year five, whether they get bipartisan support or not, that map is then in place for the remainder of the decade. So that is the congressional process. I'm going to pause here. Eleanor, to underscore again, it's about voting patterns. So, but it only takes into account the Democratic and Republican candidates. So they do not take into consideration, and they're for general elections. So there are rarely huge portions of the voting population who are supporting independent candidates in general elections. So it's just not part of the calculus.
Katie, I actually have two questions I want to hop in. They should be pretty simple, but I was just curious. So the Senate districts that are made up of three House districts, is the proportional representation requirement, does that apply to the Senate districts as well? So they couldn't like gerrymander those with like a 2-1, 1-2 sort of thing?
So it's not necessarily about a district by district analysis. It's about the map overall. So you're not looking at, so if, what Chris is talking about is the I'm going to go back a couple slides. We're talking about the representational fairness criterion here for state legislative maps. Your analysis is statewide. So the way that you judge the representational fairness is by saying across the last decade, the way that Ohioans have voted in statewide state and federal elections is a 55-45 split. That's not the exact number, but I'm just going to fill that in. It's about a 55-45 split. That said, the statewide proportion of Senate seats that are likely to be won by either Democrats or Republicans should closely reflect that 55-45 split. And so it's not necessarily a district by district analysis, it's a statewide analysis. So of all of the 99 House reps, about 55% of them should be Republicans, about 45% of them should be Democrats. Same thing with the Senate.
Cool. And then my second question is just real quick. What is the governor's role in the congressional map?
Good question. The only role that the governor has in the congressional map is in step two. If it's the commission who actually adopts the congressional map, he's on that commission. So that's one role that he plays. But if it's passed by the legislature in either steps 1, 3, or 4, the legislature will pass that map just like they would any other bill. And so that bill then has to be signed into law by the governor. So the governor could veto the map that is passed by the legislature. I highly doubt that that would happen. I can't imagine that the Republican governor would not be on the same page as the Republican-led legislature, but wilder things have happened here in Ohio, so who knows? But he holds a veto pen if it's the legislature who passes the map, and he's a commissioner if it's the commission who passes the map in step two. Bill asked a good question, which is where does the state Supreme Court fit into this map-making process? So the Supreme Court, like I said, is the first stop in any litigation train related to the redistricting process. So if there is a challenge about the process itself, so say, for example, in this congressional process, they go to step two and they didn't actually hold two hearings before the legislature voted in step one. You could go to the Supreme Court and say, excuse me, this process isn't right. They're breaking the rules. We want to challenge you. We want to have an injunction to make them hold those hearings. You go to the Ohio Supreme Court. If you're challenging the map itself, so once they pass the map, either out of the commission or the legislature, and you say, ooh, this map looks real gerrymandered, you go to the Ohio Supreme Court. They are the first people who get to judge that map. And if it is a partisan gerrymandering challenge, the only court who will ever judge that is the Ohio Supreme Court. Okay, really quickly, I'm just going to buzz us ahead to the criteria for our new congressional maps. These are all brand new. The only criteria that existed in 2011 for our congressional maps, I'm not kidding. There was literally one criteria, which was don't violate. Well, there were two criteria. One was don't violate the Ohio Constitution. And the second was don't violate any federal laws or the federal Constitution. That was it. Those were the only rules for our congressional maps, which maybe explains why they're so bad. Now we have all of these rules, which are good guardrails against the worst forms of gerrymandering. They could be better, but we'll talk about that. So the first one, similar to the state legislative maps, they've got to have contiguous borders. Again, that's one non-interrupted, non-intersecting line that makes up the border of the district. The other is that the districts are compact. This is, if you look at our current map, our congressional districts are really good at being huge, sprawling districts that bring together huge portions of the state that don't have a ton in common. So for example, Representative Jim Jordan's Duck District, the little tail goes almost all the way from the Indiana border. The belly of the duck hits into Dublin, a suburb of Columbus. The beak is all the way up by Lake Erie. That is an absolutely absurd district. Those parts of the state are very different and they do not belong in the same congressional district. So the idea here is that you are trying to centralize where those districts are located to protect communities of interest, to make sure that folks are in districts that make sense with other communities who have similar interests to their own. The next couple of criteria fit into the same umbrella that you saw with the state ledge maps, where there is a huge interest in trying to protect communities and to keep them together. The first set of rules is about how many counties we're allowed to split, if at all. Our current map of our 88 counties splits 55 of our counties into either 2, 3, or 4 congressional districts, which again is just not necessary. My favorite example always bring up when I'm talking about this is Mercer County, which has a humble 30,000 person population and yet is split into 3 different congressional districts. That is absolutely ludicrous. There is no reason a county that small should have 3 different congressional representatives. So the new rules are that 65 of our 88 counties have to be kept whole. They cannot be split apart. 18 counties may be split once. 5 counties may be split twice. The reason I am really underscoring that may is because that is not a must. You do not need to split 18 counties once and 5 twice to draw a map. You can actually draw a congressional map that has as few as 7 or 8 county splits. And that's what you're trying to go for. You want to try to keep communities together as much as possible. The next set of rules is what do we do with our major cities? Columbus is too big to fit into one congressional district, so we have to be split, but there are rules about splitting it responsibly to try to keep together as much of the urban core as possible and not doing what our current Columbus anchor district does, which is keeps a little bit of the urban core together and then gets cracked apart by other Republican urban districts. Cleveland and Cincinnati cannot be split apart. They have to remain whole within their districts. This is vastly different than our current setup, where Cleveland is split into 4 congressional districts. Cincinnati is split in half into 2 different districts. Those 2 cities have to remain together in their entirety within a congressional district. The other major cities, Akron, Dayton, and Toledo, unfortunately, there are no rules requiring that they be kept together. They absolutely should be kept together. Those are not coincidentally major Democratic hubs, so they will be targets for being cracked apart and gerrymandered. So it will be the onus will be on us to make sure that they are not. We want to make sure that those places are kept together to not dilute the political power of the folks who live there. This last criteria is the last one that applies for any 10-year map, and that is that whoever is drawing the map, whether it's the legislature or the commission, has to attempt to include at least one entire county within every single congressional district. That obviously won't apply to Franklin County, for example, where Columbus inside Franklin County has to be split apart, or if doing so would violate federal law, for example, the Voting Rights Act. But the idea here, again, is trying to keep together communities as much as possible. This last bullet point on the page is the additional stricter rules that apply only to a four-year map. It is only for four-year maps that we see an explicit ban on partisan gerrymandering for congressional maps. That is different than the state legislative process, where there's just a blanket partisan gerrymandering ban, whether it's 10-year or a four-year map. This is a huge this is one of the gaps in our reform measures, just to be honest, that we only have an explicit partisan gerrymandering ban on four-year congressional maps. So technically, for steps 1 through 3, for a 10-year map, you could partisan gerrymander, and there's not a ton that we could do to enforce that in court. The second is that there are stricter rules against unnecessarily splitting apart counties, cities, and townships. So you see sort of a ratcheting up of the rules that I just talked about for 10-year maps. The third is that map drawers only have to attempt to draw compact districts rather than being required to do so like they are for a 10-year map. And then the fourth one seems like it doesn't really matter, but it's mostly important, especially for litigation afterwards. If the legislature passes a four-year map, they have to include a written statement that explains how they met all of those additional criteria when drawing the map. And the reason that's so important is during the process itself, it's because we want to understand how legislators thought they did not partisan gerrymander, they kept communities together, they attempted to draw compact districts, and they couldn't even get a third of the Democrats to sign on to that map, right? So it's an accountability piece during the process itself, but also for potential litigation after the maps have been drawn, to be able to point to that in court and say, here are the reasons they claimed they had to draw the districts the way they did. Here's how that's not correct. So those are important criteria. I wish they were in effect for the entire process, but they're only in place for the four-year map. So that's the end of the process itself. I will pause there for the rules on the congressional districts to see what happens if there are lawsuits and they drag on to next November. A good question, Joseph. So if there are lawsuits, the courts are actually very good at making sure that they wrap them up importantly for the filing deadline for when candidates have to run under those new maps during the next election. So those actually happen in February of 2022. So that's actually the deadline for lawsuits, is getting that wrapped up. In rare instances, a court will push back a filing deadline. In even rarer cases, they will push back a primary election date. But the real sort of time crunch actually is on people who are filing the lawsuits, because they've got to get their arguments and their lawsuit together as quickly as possible to get into the court so that you can settle everything before those impending deadlines. And just to maybe answer a potential follow-up, if the Supreme Court happens to overturn a challenged map, it just goes back to whoever was in charge of drawing it. So the state ledge maps would go back to the commission. They would have to try again, or it would go back for the legislature for the congressional maps. And you hope that it gets wrapped up before the election. If it doesn't, which is often the case in redistricting cases because they take so long to get through, you could potentially have an election. You're not going to have an election under former maps, because then you would have a whole separate set of constitutional litigation over that. But that's how all that works out. One last thing that I'm going to hype before I turn the mic back over is there are a number of public engagement opportunities that are really important for us to take advantage of. Some that are baked into the process itself, others that we will organize ourselves outside of the process. So before the process even starts right now, I know Justin said that we're going to get started in September. I'm going to argue that our work has already begun organizing around redistricting. We it is incredibly important, especially because we're getting our census data so late in the year, that we have an opportunity as Ohioans to inject our voices into this redistricting process. So if you are interested in town halls, stay tuned to All in the Line. You can go to alltheline.org. You can go down to the Ohio page and sign up to be a part of our list. But we are going to be hosting town halls across the state this summer, later in July and August, as a way to talk to people about this process, to talk about what's at stake for our communities with redistricting, and importantly, to talk to folks about how they can get engaged. One other thing that I will hype, which is not in this slide, is that our official redistricting process has not started at all. The governor has not convened our commission. The legislature broke for summer recess without any announced plans for when they're going to come back into session before redistricting or scheduling any public hearings, which means that we don't have any way of telling when or if we will ever be able to engage in this process. If that bums you out as much as it bums me out, fear not. There is a separate process that is a grassroots, people-powered, independent commission. It's called the Ohio Citizens Redistricting Commission. Chris and I serve as commissioners on that commission. It is co-sponsored by the Ohio Organizing Collaborative, the Ohio chapter of the NAACP, and the A. Philip Randolph Institute in partnership with the Kerwin Institute at Ohio State. It is a great opportunity for folks to actually engage with a redistricting process since our official one has not kicked off. We host hearings across the state every second and fourth Thursday at 6 p.m. And I think Carrie, my colleague, has posted some links in the chat box. So if you are interested in joining us for those, please do. It's a great opportunity for us to actually get your voices heard before the official process starts up. During the process itself, there are requirements for hearings to be held after maps have been publicly proposed, but before they get voted on. The number of hearings that are required are not a lot. We will be pushing for many more hearings than this, but we're also preparing for getting the bare minimum and being able still to collect testimony. So we will also be hosting public testimony workshops this summer where folks can learn how best to write public comments and testimony about the redistricting process. OCRC is a great way to get practice doing that. So again, I would encourage you to go to those OCRC hearings. And then the other piece of it is publicly proposed maps, which is a great segue to our next conversation with the districter training that Chris is going to lead. The Constitution allows Ohioans to propose their own maps to the official process for consideration, which is really, really important because you want to get as much public input into this process to show that there are other fair ways to draw districts other than by gerrymandering them or whatever bad maps are getting drawn behind closed doors. So this is an incredibly important opportunity for us to make sure that what our communities need is actually reflected in the process. So I'm going to close there and turn it over to Chris. This is a good segue to get into how you can get practice drawing your own maps.
That was part of an online seminar hosted by the Ohio Environmental Council on Ohio's legislative redistricting process. You can see the rest of that video on the Ohio Environmental Council's Facebook page. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, hoping you'll be paying close attention and ready to do what needs to be done. And I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care. Nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I just keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on a freedom land. Can't let them turn me around, Lord, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I just keep on the walk, you know, I keep on the mirrors. I'm marching on a freedom land. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse, can't let it turn me around. program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course. Please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.
Hi, this is Dale McCurry, and you're listening to WCRS Community Radio for Columbus, Ohio, the home of bluegrass in this fair city. Keep listening.